You're listening to the Cynic Radio Podcast. Now, your hosts, Igri and Cynic.
You're listening to episode 47 of the Cynic Radio Podcast, and I'm your host, Cynic. And joining me, as always, the man still regretting his jump the gun, Jar Jar Binks tattoo decision, my friend and yours, Igri. Ryan George, the Jedi Master with the Jim Wits Podcast, joins us as the CRP tackles the dark side of the Star Wars franchise. We here at the Cynic Radio Podcast would like to thank you for the continued support of the show. You guys are amazing. But let's take it back. The year is 1999, and it's been about 16 years since the last Star Wars film was in theater. The movies I grew up on and loved produced thousands of toys, hundreds of books, and a few cartoons, but no new movies. But it was here, it was time. I was finally old enough to buy my own ticket, drive myself to the theater, and as I stood in line, I was hopeful, excited to see how the Jedi fell, how Anakin Skywalker became Darth Vader, and the rise of the Empire. We here at the podcast are all huge Star Wars fans, but what you're about to hear is our honest, and at times not so loving review of Star Wars: A Phantom Menace. IG, thinking all the way back to 1999, pre-Y2K, where did you see the film and was it on opening night? And since then, how many times do you think you've seen the film?
Well, yeah, I saw it on opening night at what was at the time the biggest theater in the Twin Cities. And it was also the theater that had shown all of the previous Star Wars movies on their release. So it was kind of a tradition for me to go to the same theater. At the time, no digital ticketing. You had to be in line. So I was there literally probably 12 hours early. Standing in line. Luckily, I was among the first, so I was like fifth in line and saw it opening night. Really enjoyed it because it had been about 20 years since we had Star Wars, and I was excited. And since then, probably no less than 25 times I've seen it.
So I wasn't a big Star Wars fan at the time. I don't know that I was. I'd seen the movies, but you know, I think I saw them on VHS. My dad brought them. Like, my dad never was super excited to take me to see Star Wars or anything. So I wasn't a huge fan, but my best friend at the time, he was a ginormous Star Wars fan. So we were going to go see it opening night, and we waited in line a long time. And I just thought it was a fun experience just seeing that the kind of fandom for the first time like that. And so I guess my experience after seeing it was I thought it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. I had fun. I definitely didn't think it was spectacular, but I also didn't quite get the level of hatred that kind of grew and developed over the next, you know, few months and years. And, you know, it wasn't really until seeing everything in context and becoming a bigger fan that I really understood, you know, where a lot of that came from.
Yeah, it was the same for me. I mean, there hours and hours early. I think I even pre-bought a ticket. What surprised me, though, was I think I only got to see one of them originally in the theater because I was too young. I was basically the only Star Wars fan I knew growing up. So without the internet and without being able to connect to other people, it was like almost like being home for me. Everybody was in costume. Everybody was in a good mood. Everybody's excited to see the film. I think I've seen it since it came out, since opening night, I probably at least 20 times, because every once in a while I'll get in these moods where I'm going to sit down and watch them all. And unfortunately, I've got to start with this one chronologically. And that sometimes takes the steam out of my marathon. But I do appreciate the film and everything it is and what it brings to the genre. IG, what if we waited all this time and the movie sucks? If you are a Star Wars fan and you haven't seen the 2009 film Fanboys, starring most notably Kristen Bell, you need to see it. It's practically a companion piece for this movie. But before we get to the plot, what was your feeling of the Jedi Padawan combo, being Qui-Gon Jinn, played by Liam Neeson, and the recasted younger Ben Kenobi, played by one of my favorite actors, Ewan McGregor?
I really liked the combo. First of all, they're both strong actors. I mean, Liam had done some amazing things leading up to that. Rob Roy being one of them, a few other things. He's been around quite a long time. I've been surprised lately that I'm watching some older movies and all of a sudden, hey, there's Liam Neeson. So, and quite honestly, if you kind of looked at Ewan McGregor, because I saw some pictures, like, because the internet was pretty early. I mean, it was around, but it wasn't what it is today. But there were some people putting pictures of Alec Guinness and Ewan McGregor side by side, and he's a likely candidate to pass as Obi-Wan. And I think the job that they did was at a minimum passable, but most of the time very, very well done.
That was one of the highlights of the movie. You know, when I first saw it and in future viewings, I do think that the combination was strong. I think that Liam Neeson as Qui-Gon brought the kind of, I guess, heaviness or the depth that's needed for that part, and to play a master. And we've never seen, we've never seen a Jedi master as a Jedi master, before at that point. So I think he brought the right kind. And I think the Padawan master, but the Padawan Jedi connection was really strong between the two of them. So I think I liked McGregor as Obi-Wan. I think he did a really good job kind of portraying it and bringing out his inner Alec Guinness. So I really like that team in the movie. It's one of the strong points of the movie for me.
It really was great to kind of see the characters from the start, to jump back, because we all knew Ben Kenobi, but we never really knew his origin. We didn't know anything about him. I mean, we were reliant on the books up until this point to fill in the gaps that the movies left us. It was nice to see the Jedi, the Master Padawan combo. It was nice to see the way the scenes were acted between the two. You kind of got a sense of a connection, which you would want if someone's training you in the ways of the Force. I was really happy with the casting. Even though they aren't as household names as they are now, they performed beautifully together. To me, it was a shame that it really only lasted the extent of one film. Sorry, spoiler alert. These Federation types are cowards. The negotiations will be short. As our heroes are double-crossed and gassed by the Trade Federation, the Jedi fight their way out of the room, sabers swing. Ryan, we see the Viceroy's army consists mostly of robots. What did you think of their troops, and did you think they were as formidable as the stormtroopers that we're used to?
Well, anything could be as formidable as the stormtroopers that we're used to, but I thought, and even being pretty young at the time, I was still in high school. I remember thinking like, well, okay, so it's a kid's movie. It's not, but it is, right? So they're not going to be killing humans throughout. And I guess, stormtroopers would be redundant. So it made sense to have them, have robots or droids, because you could do whatever you want with them. And it's not, it still fits the kind of mold of, being okay for kids to watch. But I thought that I was really impressed with the CGI at the time. And I think they did a really good job I think George Lucas did a great job with the CGI, in the movie. And I was never kind of taken out of it. I don't know that it's held up as well, but I think at the time I was really impressed by it. And I thought they were, I don't know how formidable they were. They were kind of used a lot for comic relief, but it definitely wasn't really a weak point for me in the movie. I think in Star Wars, we're used to the villains, not really, outside of the main villains, everybody else is just kind of cannon fodder, essentially.
A world of red shirts. IG, what do you think of the robots?
Well, the thing is I likened them to stormtroopers probably immediately, at least the battle droids themselves. They were kind of lanky. They were humanoid as far as their shape, and they weren't super effective, right? But the difference between a stormtrooper and a battle droid is a stormtrooper by its look alone inspires a bit of fear. And the battle droids were almost more commercially grounded. Good thing to sell. It's a toy thing. And I understand that, Lucas made a bunch of money, most of his money, in fact, on the merchandising. This was an opportunity to create something that, while on the bad guys team, is still fun, and we can sell the hell out of this toy. They were a good job, though. I mean, the thing is when you have 100,000 of anything, that's a formidable force. The droidicas seemed like they were more effective as far as actually fighting, although they didn't really do anything to the Jedis besides put up a shield and shoot a whole bunch of rounds at them. But I question their mobility. I question their mobility when they're not stationary and shooting, because it seemed like they were pretty clunky. There were some good things with those initial droids that we saw. I mean, in later movies, they add some different droids, but initially, I was like, okay, those are the stormtroopers, and I don't know what these things are. Maybe AT-STs that can't turn quickly and make adjustments.
Myself, I wasn't a big fan of any of it. The droidicas were cool in the sense that, they actually gave the Jedis a challenge. They have force shields, they're heavy firepower. The fear was good because, it wasn't even cannon fodder with the regular battle droids. They almost kind of made fun of them the whole time, which rightfully so, because I just thought I didn't like the look, I didn't like the feel, I didn't like the fact that they said the same thing over and over again. It seemed like a big money grab as far as toys from start to go with it. I have a bad feeling about this, Ryan. As the Jedi stow away on the Federation ship to the surface of Naboo with the invasion force, we run into what is considered the biggest black eye on the Star Wars franchise. You guessed it, Jar Jar fucking Binks. Your opinion on the Gungan menace, and did you realize he would be a constant pain in the ass the whole trilogy?
I thought he was annoying, but it wasn't as annoying to me as I think the reaction in the fandom became. And I think on subsequent viewings, I find him more and more annoying. And I don't know if it's because I've allowed that opinion to kind of fester in me or if he just is that annoying. I definitely know that, by episode two, I was more, I know we're not talking about that yet, but I was more annoyed with him then. But again, I don't know how much of it was just the seed being planted of him being horrible. I mean, he definitely was not pleasant and I didn't like him as a character, but I didn't hate him either. I just thought it was kind of silly and whatever. It's like, again, I felt the whole time it really felt like a kid's movie. So I was like, all right, you need this for the kids. And I didn't realize how big the fandom was. So I don't know. I wasn't as annoyed as everybody else, but I get it. I'm glad that they reduced his role in subsequent movies.
IG, was this a toy marketing scheme gone wrong, or was he designed to annoy us to death, like a middle finger to the hardcore fandom?
Well, it was a cross between a toy marketing scheme and trying to add some quote-unquote plucky comedy relief, right? So they're adding a Jerry Lewis where you already have a Laurel and Hardy, right? You already have R2-D2 and C-3PO. They exist in all of these movies so far. They're the comedy relief. And then they tried to add another one. And that's where I think the hate comes from. It's a bad accent, a goofy looking character, taking time away from these other characters. And that's where I think it all kind of boils down to. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, there's some goofy things that take away in the moment of what's going on with Jar Jar. And I think that's what the grading part is. I mean, if you just ignore the Jar Jar points, there are only like one or two points where he's at all important, even a minimum amount. So it's really not as bad. I think, I had a point in the middle of my like 25 viewings that I absolutely hated him. And then something clicked where I was like, okay, but if I just kind of, first of all, remember that I'm kind of old and I'm trying to remember Star Wars from when I was a little kid. And just remember, this is a kid's movie and watch it for what it is. It's actually gotten better, which is kind of odd to say. I mean, the accent still grates on me. Some of the actions still grate on me, but it's not as bad as it was. So yes, toy grab, definitely, but trying to add extra comedy relief where the extra wasn't needed.
I think you're just still trying to justify that Jar Jar tramp stamp that you have on your back.
Oh, Jar Jar is the shit.
Listen, it's never gotten better for me. And I realized that this was an outreach to a whole new generation of Star Wars fans. And we were looking at kids from 8 to 80, trying to pull them in and trying to give them something to embrace, much like they are now. It really could be phase three where, we're reaching out to different age brackets and different nationalities and different lifestyles. And I hated it. I hate it, and I hate it every time I see it, and it almost makes the first movie unwatchable. And I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and it pains me to say that this seems to be the one thing that everybody fucking picks out to throw barbs at you whenever they find out that you like Star Wars. Like, oh, what about that Jar Jar shit? I'm like, listen, dude, I didn't make the movie. I just enjoy the franchise. So, IG, the Trade Federation seems to be in league with some shadowy cloak-like figure. How long did it take you to realize who he was and what he was up to?
Well, it didn't take me all that long, but again, huge Star Wars fan, right? It looked like the Emperor. It was the Emperor, although not the Emperor yet. So that's one thing that the prequels brought us was how that happened. Why is he the Emperor? The big surprise to that, right? You have this shadowy Emperor saying, do these things and everything, and all of a sudden in walks another dude in a black cloak. And I'm like, ooh, immediately, like that was a chill moment. That was like, wow. I remember way back then, and even now when I watch it, I'm like, that is just kind of cool. Darth Maul coming in. Wow.
Yeah, even though he didn't do anything in that scene, it was still really, really impactful. Just him standing behind the Emperor is like, ooh, this is a better version of Darth Vader. I can't wait to see what this guy is up to. The Jedi's rescue Queen Amidala and company, and they take off for Coruscant. But due to mechanical failure, we get introduced to everyone's favorite droid, R2-D2. Ryan, how do you feel that the introduction to R2-D2 was handled?
Yes, I thought it was a cool way to introduce him. Again, it's, as everything is in this universe, it's a little convenient that you know, all these characters kind of for a movie about a galaxy. People are very, very close and there are way too many conveniences. But again, that's, you know, that's the world. That's Star Wars. And that's one of the things we love about it. So I thought it was a cool way to introduce him. And again, it was one of those things where it was like a great kind of fan service moment where, again, I knew the characters and I'd seen the movies. I just wasn't a huge fan at the time. So I think it was a cool fan service moment and a point where, you know, like you're in Star Wars. That's the first, you know, it's the first time you really, that's one of, you know, that's one of the characters you grew up with and he's right there, you know, in front of you. So, you know, it was a really, I think it was a cool moment that worked well.
I liked it as an origin moment as well. I mean, you know, all the other asteroids are being blasted off the ship and R2 comes and saves the day. I did find it a little weird that they suddenly started hanging out with him. I mean, if you bring your car to the mechanic and he fixes it real well, you don't invite him over for dinner, but suddenly this droid is following him everywhere. What did you think of the whole turn of events, IG?
Well, you know, the droid following him everywhere, I mean, at the time, I mean, it's a tool, right? They're taking it with him so that he can do whatever it is he needs to do. I mean, he's not all that effective of a tool because he's on wheels, but it's kind of a tool. So, and that's the thing, is you see a lot of people in this universe walking around with droids. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, this is my seeing eye dog, I guess, in the way that I'm looking at it. I didn't mind that because all the other Star Wars movies had people with droids following them around. I mean, it was Luke, R2 followed Luke everywhere. So it really didn't bother me. I understand exactly what you're saying, but it didn't bother me because it's Star Wars to me. And that's always what Star Wars had done. They've always got C-3PO following people around, tripping over things and saying the odds are against you and everything else. But R2 was always following somebody and saving the day. I mean, he'd saved the day so many times, it's hard to remember how many times he did.
So we end up on good old Tatooine, and we meet a very mechanically talented and extremely talkative young boy. I'm a person, and my name is Anakin. The one thing I can say for young Annie is he spotted Natalie Portman right away. And I know growing up, I most certainly did as well. IG, did episode 1 Tatooine capture the original trilogy Tat? And did the pod racing scenes help or hurt the movie? Or was it a simple case of style over substance?
By this time, we had already had the special editions. So they had changed what Tatooine kind of looked like a little bit already. I think they went a little overboard in the amount of stuff that they put there. Because this, you know, went from more of a desolate planet with a little bit of stuff going on. Hive of Scumvin Villainy, which, you know, shouldn't be a bustling metropolis, to more bustling. And I'm like, okay, this is a little busy. That bothered me a little bit, all the stuff happening as they were going into, what, Mos Espa, I think, in this one. And the pod racing scene. Now, the pod racing scene was great. It was a lot of fun. It was really long. And that's my complaint with that. It did not need to be like 25 minutes because it was around that range. It was an amazingly long scene. It's like, you know, the space battles in any of the previous movies didn't last that long on their own. Because the thing is during this, nothing else is happening. It's simply pod racing. Like, even the space battle scenes at the end of any of the other ones, you've got all kinds of other things happening at the same time. So they're cutting back and forth to things. And the only thing they're cutting back and forth to this is the look of, oh my God, to the people watching the pod race. And that, it should have been about half the time because it was cool enough to have a longer scene, but not 25 minutes. That was way too much.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a well done scene. I don't hate the scene, and you know, yeah, pretty much echoing everything Ike said. It was done well. It was just way too long. And you're right. Like, when a lot of the pivotal scenes were cutting between different characters' perspectives, what's going on? There are multiple threads going on at the same time that are, you know, at some point going to converge. But in this, we just get one scene of him, you know, kind of emotionlessly, you know, driving the pod racer. And again, while it's a well done scene, and I think it really was able to showcase their ability to work with CGI, it was kind of unnecessary to spend that much time on it when, you know, there were so many other things we could have explored and so many other things we wanted and could have gotten more of in the movie. I think, I would have taken half the time and it still would have been strong and gotten everything across that it needed to get across.
Yeah, it just went on way too long. It wasn't very compelling. I mean, visually, it was fun and stimulating and interesting and, you know, something that I'd never even imagined in the Star Wars universe. But when we break it down, it could have been half the time, and we could have maybe, if we're going to spend that long on it, maybe mixed some other plot or storyline into it so we could switch between the two. That way, it just became very Anakin saturated. It was just way too much of the character, and a small part of me in subsequent viewings was kind of hoping he would just crash the pod and we could move on from this.
You know, and the thing is, it would have been half the time, but double the impact, and that's where they went way too long with it.
With his ability to pod race and his high midichlorian blood count and a can-do attitude, the Jedi's decide to take young Anakin home with them. Your thoughts on young Anakin and his instant connection to Padme? I mean, did they push a little too hard in the storyline? I mean, did they rush it?
You know, I think, honestly, because of the age difference between Anakin at that time and Padme, it was awkward. It was strange to try and make a 9-year-old boy almost romantically involved or thinking romantically about a late teens girl. So that seemed forced and pushed. And you can't get a boy, no matter how good of an actor he is, you can't get a 9-year-old boy to show that kind of involvement with a girl. Yeah, she might have been pretty and are you an angel and all those stuff he said earlier. You could have made that work, but they almost tried to make him lustful and it just seemed off. That's one of the complaints, and Jake Lloyd didn't do a great job on that, but I can't honestly blame Jake Lloyd because he's a little kid, right? You can't say, you know, you should have done better. No, they should have written the lines better. They should have directed better. They should have done the other things better. It's not really Jake Lloyd's fault. And I know he's taken a lot of guff over the years from the internet, but it's not him, right? You know, that was poor writing. That was poor directing.
Yeah. Outside of the Jar Jar thing and how annoying young Anakin was, one of the worst parts of the trilogy was the ongoing writing of the storyline between the romance of the two. From this, you're right, Egg, it was super creepy to start. I mean, and it gets, but the dialogue even gets worse as the romance goes on. And if you ever want to annoy your significant other, and she's a Star Wars fan, just start quoting lines that Anakin does to Padme, and they will absolutely want to slap you by the time you're done.
I hate sand. It gets everywhere.
Hold me like you did in the Lake of Naboo. Ryan, the extended coffee break that Lucas took, we ushered out the old school puppets and models, and it was replaced by a younger, sleeker, sexier CGI. In your opinion, did it make the movies better, or did you lose some of that Star Wars feel? And did it make episodes 4 through 6 look slightly outdated?
Again, I think in some ways the CGI was done really well, but for what it's worth, I remember, you know, seeing some shows and different things over the years that there were a good deal of practical effects used for it. It's just that the CGI was so over the top that it really, like, it kind of just hit you in the face. And so, while it looked good visually, a lot of it really did. It wasn't the same world. Like, it wasn't the gritty world that we're used to. And that was part of Star Wars. And even in the special editions, you get the same thing when you watch the special editions compared to, the unedited versions. Like, there's a huge difference because you really get a feel for the world. And while, yeah, it's a little bit cleaner and there's way more bells and whistles, it's just not, it doesn't feel the same. And so I think that it would be a strike against the prequel trilogy that, while the CGI was good, it could have been used to better effect if he had toned down on that and really enhanced when they did use practical effects, like really showcase that. So yeah, I think it's a bit of a strike against the prequel trilogy that the CGI was just way overdone.
One of the things that one of the things the special edition did is some of the things for CGI were amazing and that belonged there, and some of the things didn't. And the real easy designator for that is anything that had to do with a vehicle. Anything they did to a vehicle to improve how it looked from the original worked amazingly. When you added all those extra X-Wings to the final battle in A New Hope, that was great. But when you start adding CGI to characters, that just takes what was real to us all and lessens it. So the main point here, the biggest thing we lost, a character that we all knew and loved from the original trilogy, Yoda. Yoda was a puppet in the beginning, right? Yoda was a puppet in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And now we get a fully CGI'd Yoda. And you can tell It's not the same Yoda. It doesn't look the same, doesn't act the same. Now, I understand that they may not have been able to use the same puppet, but I have a hard time believing they couldn't have recreated a puppet and done it that way and use CGI to take out the puppet ear when they've got them doing other things. That's where I lost it. Like, you know, brand new characters, you want to CGI them? Okay, right? But when you have a classic character, when you have somebody that has already existed in the universe and you change them completely, that's where you lose me. That's where it becomes a problem because it's like, well, it's Yoda, but it's not.
Yeah, I had a real problem with some of that stuff as well, especially I don't want to turn it into a special edition debate, but especially with the adding of Anakin at the end of one of the movies, too. I didn't like any of that. But you're right. Whenever they threw more X-Wings in, whenever they threw more Stormtroopers in, the ability to put that Jabba scene in and make it look good and reasonable. I liked all that. I'm not as offended by the special editions as some of the other more hardcore Star Wars fans, because I thought in ways they enhanced the movies, and I thought it was an attempt to not make them look so dated. But I agree. I think we should have gotten a very similar feel to Yoda rather than like this CGI super ninja.
Well, and they still had Frank Oz. Frank Oz was still doing the voice. Why couldn't they just have let him puppeteer as well?
Because he was 150 years old at the time, IG.
He's still alive, so he's got to be 125 now. So
we got the hyperdrive fixed, ship's ready to go, and we're attacked by one of the most awesome characters ever created in Star Wars. Amazingly agile, menacing looking, dark. Maul. They barely escape with their lives. IG, as Star Wars fans, we all grew up with a little bit of Vader envy. I mean, with the exception of Han Solo, the dark side or the Imperial side or the bad guys were always given the much cooler villains than we got heroes. What was your thought upon seeing Darth Maul in action?
Well, you know, having only seen a quote-unquote Sith Lord in Darth Vader up to this point, you know, it was almost like the Frankenstein. It was slow and lumbering and but very definitive. It's like, I'm just going to move in this path because I don't have to run. He's kind of like the Pepe Le Pew of Star Wars, right? I'll just walk after you and I'll catch you eventually. This guy rolling in on that speeder bike, flipping off, doing backflips and racing and everything else. I was like, whoa, where did this come from? You know, it was wholly unexpected. Right up until that moment. Now, like, we had seen trailers and everything and seen this cool guy with a red and black face. And he was like, oh, that guy looks cool. And then he starts doing this stuff. It's like, whoa, that guy is cool. You know, I mean, he hadn't said much at that point, which I don't think he says more than 8 words in the whole movie, which is just fine. To see a Jedi flipping around and doing everything that Darth Maul does. Wow. That was my impression then. And I stand by it now that he is still one of the coolest characters to ever come around.
He really was impact. I mean, from the second he hit the screen, it was, holy shit, this is the best thing ever. And this goes back to my question of the new movies making the movie old movies look bad. The only point of reference we had was Darth Vader, and he could barely swing his lightsaber at times, and he had a little bit of use of the Force, and it was really toned down and really... And finally, this isn't your father's Jedi. I mean, Darth Maul hits the scene, and it's everything that you would imagine or want a Jedi fight to be. A couple years later, the reason IG and I met was a game called Star Wars Galaxies, which was an online MMO. And the impact of Darth Maul was that you could have been any number of species. Just about everybody chose Zabrak. Everybody wanted to be Darth Maul. Everybody ran around with characters looking like Darth Maul. I was excited about the character. I mean, it makes Vader look terrible, and Vader really didn't get a good go until, you know, just recently in Rogue One, where he finally looked like the badass that we all wanted him to be. So Darth Maul, definitely one of the best characters ever. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think his impact was huge in that moment, and for the time that he was in the movie, I think he, you know, the look, everything about him, they got right. And without going too far into the movie at this point, I think just the look was great. The way he moved. Yeah, we rarely saw that in anything, you know, let alone Star Wars. So, you know, I think, again, one of the great things about the prequels was that the fight choreography was just phenomenal. A lot of the times, you know, sometimes it could get a little over the top, but it was so much better than what we had gotten in the original trilogy that, you know, it was fantastic. And I remember even seeing that, thinking, wow, this is really cool. Like seeing guys, you know, seeing a guy with a lightsaber versus a Jedi, and they're not just like kind of weakly, you know, swinging their swords at each other. They're moving, like they're athletes. They look like real, you know, fighters. Like that was really cool to watch.
So we finally reach Coruscant, IG, and we meet good old Senator Palpatine, who's doing everything he can in the blockade Naboo in the Senate. However, the Supreme Chancellor is weak, and we need to have a quick vote of no confidence, and that would help. And that will help to install a more powerful person in that position. So, this could only go one way, right? Before there was a Game of Thrones Littlefinger, we had Senator Palpatine. How soon did you become aware of what was hiding behind everything he was up to in this so well hidden but obvious power grab?
I knew immediately, but again, Star Wars nerd, right? I got it. Palpatine, you know, he was Emperor Palpatine. I got it. You know, and I know that this was kind of the beginning of the end. This is where the power would start to shift to him. I didn't mind it. I just thought that, you know, it seemed a little convenient how quickly he got things to work. But then again, if you look at it the other way, the person that he tried to get to call for the vote of no confidence was the person whose planet was being directly affected. So trying to, and she's young, right? They're saying that she was like 16, 17 at the time, queen of the planet. And you're going to try and coerce her into something, and everything you say sounds logical. Well, if it all sounds logical, then why not, right? If I can save my planet, if I can save my people by trying to move some power around, then let's do this. So while it seemed convenient, it also made sense. I did like it, and I did like Ian McDiarmid. He's a good actor. He's been around a long time, just like some of these other actors. And he did a pretty good job of kind of doing that used car salesman look and voice and everything to try and sell what he was trying to do to take over the galaxy.
I thought the scheme in itself, hence the name of the movie, The Phantom Menace, I thought the scheme in itself was pretty ingenious. I mean, to create all this and then to install yourself into power. But I know, Ryan, one of your pet peeves is things being rushed. Did the whole scheme feel rushed in the context of the movie?
It's funny. It is a huge pet peeve. I think in movies, because you don't have a lot of time, I give it a little bit more room, or you know, a little more leeway with the movie. I never got the feeling that it was rushed. It definitely felt convenient, but I loved Ian McDiarmid's performance. I think he's one of the best things about the entire movie, and I love he was able to kind of subtly, you know, when he needed to be a little snivelly, he was snivelly. When he needed to be conniving, he was conniving. When he needed to be menacing, he was, you know, throughout the trilogy, when he needed to be menacing, he was menacing. So I loved his performance, and you know, we'll get into this a little bit more as we go on, but I think I loved a lot of the ideas behind the movie, and sometimes the execution wasn't quite there. So in this case, I love the idea of him, you know, of him setting everything up to put himself into power, but maybe the execution could have been a little bit better. But either way, I think I liked about that, you know, the performance and the idea, I think that was enough for me to say that this was, you know, I liked it versus, you know, maybe it being a little bit rushed and a little too convenient.
Now, I realize this is set in the fall of the Jedi, right? We're trending down at this point. The Jedi, their stock they're tanking. But Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, they return back to the council. They report the rise of the Sith, which is basically disregarded. They outright refuse to train Anakin. Well, you got this kid. We don't know where he came from. Kind of befuddling a little bit. Did you have a problem with the way that the council itself was portrayed? I mean, they seemed clueless. They seemed almost powerless. They're like, we're just along for the ride. You know, we don't really know any. Meanwhile, these guys are supposed to be the most powerful guys in the universe. They're supposed to have all these powers and wisdom. And they kind of look like a group of fools just sitting on silly little chairs.
And this kind of likened right to a more recent thing, like the Maesters here in the last season of Game of Thrones, where somebody is honestly standing there telling them this is happening. And they're like, yeah, great. We just think it's not. It just history repeating itself, because they did it here in The Phantom Menace and now they're doing it in Game of Thrones. I found that, you know, a group of Jedi not willing to assess every situation kind of made me question what was going on. Did they get so powerful that they thought that nothing could usurp them? Did they get so powerful that they thought there's no way anything could get by us? And that's what it seemed like. And it's not true, right? You know, they're too full of themselves to realize what's going on.
Again, we talk about it's a galaxy, but everything is so small that it doesn't quite fit. But in this case, if you are dealing with an order, no matter how many, you know, thousands of members there are that are defending an entire galaxy, you can't address every single threat and every single issue. And you do have to weigh things, you know, and kind of investigate and determine, like, is this worth pursuing? So I wasn't maybe as bothered by it. I guess I do feel like, you know, Qui-Gon was somebody who should have at least been, you know, his opinion should mean something. So the fact that they kind of just dismissed it out of hand didn't quite, you know, doesn't quite fit. You'd think that they'd at least give him a little bit more time, or at least investigate a little bit. But I kind of feeling like with a galaxy sized problems, that maybe it's easier to say, all right, well, we need more evidence than just, you know, more than just kind of circumstantial evidence or someone's word. You know, I can kind of get that. But again, the execution wasn't all that great for it.
Yeah, when that someone's word, though, is another Jedi Master, I think it would carry a little more weight.
Fair,
I mean, didn't seem to carry any weight, because they're like, well, you know, Qui-Gon's still kind of an outlier. Even though we've given him the rank of master, he still kind of believes some things that the rest of the order doesn't kind of take into, because they kept saying like, he's big on the living force and everything, and we're just more on the force. And they just tried to explain it away, like, but he's still a master and that should carry weight, and it didn't. And that's what, even at the time, kind of bothered me. It's like a master is showing up. Now, he's not part of the Jedi Council, which are still masters, or maybe you look at them more like grandmasters. But grandmasters that assigned a title to somebody and they still don't want to listen to him seems odd. Seems off.
He had been kind of a rebel, so like maybe that could be part play into it. But you're right, like it is a Jedi Master, so his words should mean something. But it could also be part of, well, you know, he's always kind of on the fringe, you know, and he's always, you know, there maybe are issues with him, so they're maybe a little bit skeptical. More skeptical to, you know, with what he has to bring to them. But yeah, no, I definitely agree that there should have been more than just kind of outright, you know, dismissal. That was a little strange, but yeah, it was, again, kind of part of the writing. I think that could have been, you know, done better. It could have been better with a better writer. That scene would have, you know, could have played out, you know, stronger.
Our heroes return to Naboo to straighten some shit out, and the battle's on. The Gungans agree to attack as a diversion to draw the robot forces away from the city, and the Jedi and the Naboo soldiers attack the city's capital, trying to capture the Viceroy. Again, I have a problem with this, and somewhat of the most convenient writing in the whole franchise. Somehow Anakin knows how to fly a Naboo fighter and destroys the mothership from inside with the help of autopilot, R2, and a whole lot of bullshit I don't want to get into, shutting down all the droids and securing the win. Ryan, what was your feeling on this horse shit?
Well, kind of foreshadowing for The Force Awakens, but they at least they found ways to explain it away in kind of extended universe or whatever. It didn't bother me in the moment, but yeah, watch on subsequent viewings. It's like, wait, what's this? Like this, you know, this is crazy. I mean, I know he's powerful and he's, you know, obviously very intelligent, but that was very convenient writing. And I didn't, you know, it's one of the things that kind of, it does take away from the movie quite a bit, that, you know, at least find a way to explain it. And maybe that's why they gave us that, you know, the 25-30 minutes of him of the pod racing scene to show that, oh, look, he's great with vehicles, so yeah, sure, he can learn to fly really quickly. But yeah, it wasn't the best, definitely wasn't the best scene or the best thought out part of the movie.
Yeah, we were owed an apology after that one. I mean, in context, I mean, this was this episode's Death Star, and he just casually flew in, not knowing what's going on, kind of crashed, looked around, shot the right thing, got out okay, and, you know, we win. I'm not buying it. I don't like it. It makes me cringe every time I watch this movie. I thought it was just terrible and terribly convenient writing. It's probably the biggest black eye as far as this in a series of black eyes in this movie, because we just don't have enough eyes to blacken. I have a real problem with this. IG, what do you think?
Well, all we needed, the only thing the scene was missing, was a yippee, and we'd have been fine.
Oh,
if the
God.
Kid would have yelled yippee. And we'd all been sold, right? No, it was terrible. I mean, at least in these other movies, they explained that there's something you can do to make your plan work. No, this was all just happenstance. It's just, and a kid can, you know, I mean, I have to imagine that there's got to be some difference between flying a space fighter and a pod racer. There's got to be some difference. It can't be exactly the same. So just because the kid can pod race, he's been on Tatooine as long as he can remember. He doesn't know anything about being in space and flying a spaceship. Yes, it bothered me. It was a problem. And especially when nobody had, I mean, even the Naboo fighters themselves, the people that were trained and were flying those ships, had no idea what to do to stop the droid invasion. They didn't know, and all of a sudden he just, like you said, crashes in. Oh, let's shoot that. Bing, bing. All right, I'm leaving now. No. No, no, no. It needs to stop.
Ultimately, the good guys win the day, but more importantly, what saves the movie and what I love about this movie is the 2-on-1 fight between Darth Maul and Kenobi and Qui-Gon Jinn. IG, was this everything that you thought a lightsaber battle should be? And did you like the use of the shield walls to build up tension and to slow the pace?
It was everything. And, you know, this is our first shot at a double-bladed lightsaber as well, this whole fight. It was amazing. And watching this Sith Master fight off two capable Jedi for a long time. And the music they used with this, the Duel of the Fates, that new song from John Williams, who, you know, I hope he makes it through the rest of the Star Wars movies, at least the rest of the saga. Hope he doesn't pass off because his music is so integral to what's going on. But this song, with the voices they used and everything in it, really helped build the tension and tell a story as they were going along, because it got faster and harder and everything else was going on. And Darth Maul is literally kicking their asses 90% of the time. And so, yeah, and then the shield walls, and you see Darth Maul there just looking with his teeth all gritty and everything, like, come on, man. I loved it because it did slow it down and you gave anticipation, like, okay, they're this far away. It's happening. The final countdown is on its way.
Yeah, I agree. It was really well done. I think for all the chaos and, you know, up and down kind of craziness of the movie, that was really, really well done. I think, again, it built off of that initial scene really well. And having the 2-on-1, you could see how formidable and how strong he was. You know, he didn't need to say anything. His movements were terrifying. He was scary. I love that scene. I mean, it was just one of the, you know, in the entire series, it might be the best, lightsaber battle, you know, of the entire series. You know, if you know, just offhand, I can't think of anything that I really like better than it. It was just so well done. And again, yeah, the music was perfect. And yeah, I do hope that John Williams is around for as long as there are Star Wars movies, because, I mean, he just does an incredible job. And again, one of the highlights of this movie, you know, was the music and was Duel of the Fates. It was just fantastic and as perfect of like music to accompany, you know, what we're seeing on the screen.
It really was impactful. And they do this again in the third movie too, when there's a big battle where the music actually makes the battle. It sets the tone and it complements it perfectly. This saved the movie for me. If it wasn't for this 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, I probably would never rewatch it again. But the greatness of everything that is Darth Maul and the battle between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan against him, I loved every second of it. I can't get enough of it. I wish they spent as long as that on that as they did on the stupid pod racing. I mean, in the end, the heroes win the day, but everybody loses. IG, what's your thoughts on the demise of Qui-Gon, the battle itself, and us losing Darth Maul after one film?
The battle with Qui-Gon, losing Qui-Gon, that needed to happen. I liked that happening because we needed to move Obi-Wan up, because we had already known from episode 4 that Obi-Wan had taught Anakin. Right. So that means that although Qui-Gon wanted to teach Anakin, we needed to remove Qui-Gon from the picture. I was fine with that. What I was not fine with was losing what is the baddest man that we have ever seen in this series in one movie. They didn't need to keep creating Sith Lords. all the time to make this happen, right? We could have just had Darth Maul as the big bad until Vader came around. Now, I'm not the person making the money decisions and everything, but I can't imagine Ray Park cost that much money to have doing that role. I mean, he hasn't done much since. What, he did one X-Men movie and has some bit parts and some other things. He was in Fanboys, though, so I'll give him that. Losing Darth Maul was a huge blow. Now, and even the way they lost him was very Boba Fett-like. If I can bring up another reference, right? You know, real quick, real kind of like, ah, really? That's how we're going to lose him? Just one whap. Oh, you're done.
Cut in half, no less.
Cut in half. That's all she wrote. You know, I mean, the speed at which it happened was just as easy and fast as the speed at which Boba Fett got killed off in Return of the Jedi that I'm sure we'll talk about in the next few weeks. We'll get to that. But yeah, it just... it hurt to watch somebody so cool go away so fast.
I agree. And it's kind of for a kind of overseer in Lucas who is focused on merchandise. You would think that setting up a, because this is my thought was, wow, we're going to see Vader versus Maul at some point. You know, I mean, just that would have been amazing. And so to have him go so quickly with such, you know, a large but short presence didn't make sense. And yeah, the way he went, the whole battle was great, but it didn't work for me. And you know, Qui-Gon had to go, that made sense, but to have him go like that really just didn't do service to the character and to what they had done to build him up. That at that point, he, you know, was the best thing about that movie. And you know, at a minimum, it's like, okay, well, that would give us something to look forward to in episode two. And unfortunately, just, you know, through the prequel trilogy, nobody lives up to what Maul, and he, again in his short time in that movie, he did so much, and I don't think they ever met that. And so yeah, it would have been great to see him, you know, in the, you know, throughout the trilogy as the villain or the kind of the person that Vader would have to defeat in order to, you know, to move on or to become Darth Vader. But we just never got to see that.
That really would have been amazing if they did set up that showdown, because we wouldn't have had to wait all the way to Rogue One to see a badass Vader. A Vader Maul fight would have set the tone, and I would have loved it to death. They tried to rectify this mess or this bad decision, and I think they know it was a bad decision on the Clone Wars cartoon, because we got several different reincarnations of Darth Maul, you know, one with a spider body, but don't get me started on that. But they did bring him back, and I mean, he was around for a little bit longer as far as the canon goes now, but I thought that was a huge mistake, and I thought they dropped the ball on that. But the fight did make the whole movie for me. It's the reason why I rewatched the movie, is those small glimpses of this ultra villain that we got that just got snuffed away so quickly. Ryan, your final thoughts on the movie and your rating.
Final thoughts on the movie. So, you know, on rewatching it, so it's a, you know, movie I probably, of the prequels, I've seen, definitely seen Revenge of the Sith the most. When we get to it, I have issues with Attack of the Clones. But The Phantom Menace I liked, I still like. I think it had, in spite of all of its problems, it's a fun movie. And it has enough good that I really do enjoy watching it. It does feel like Star Wars. I think it's a little bit, you know, it doesn't fully have the feeling, but of all the movies, I think it the most feels like the original trilogy. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's not my favorite by any stretch of all the movies that have come out at this point. And I think it does have its flaws, but in spite of its flaws, I think I do like the performances by Ewan McGregor. I like the performance. I like Liam Neeson. I like the setup with Palpatine. You know, Maul is great. That final battle is amazing. So there's enough good in it that I would give it, you know, maybe a 7.5. I don't, you know, Jar Jar is annoying, but I think, like Ike said, it doesn't drive me as crazy as everybody else, and I just kind of ignore it, so it doesn't bother me all that much. And so yeah, I definitely enjoy it more so than you know, when we get to Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I mean, for me, it was like a brand new relationship. Everything is new and fresh and beautiful, and you can't get enough of it. And I saw it on opening night. I was there with my ticket and my popcorn, and despite the Annie and Jar Jar problems, I was fully sold. I mean, we're getting new Star Wars film content, which we hadn't, you know, since I was a little boy. And I loved how fresh and new it made it again. The Jedi battles were great. They were fast paced. pace. They were acrobatic. I loved Darth Maul. I loved all the foreshadowing with Palpatine and the rise of the Emperor. That being said, after that, the luster kind of wore off. And every single time, I grew to kind of dislike the film more and more for the reasons that they kind of outweighed why I loved the film. And, you know, I try to tend to avoid it whenever I can. Unfortunately, I give it a 6.5. You know, I'll probably watch it a few more times in my lifetime, but this is the one that I'll always tend to avoid and always be ranked last as far as the Star Wars canon. I mean, unless they really drop the ball in the next few movies.
You guys are both really nice, because I can't give this any more than a 6. You know, there are enough things to redeem it that I will continue to watch it, right? It is Star Wars, and I guess that my 6 rating on this is based purely off of Star Wars. There's enough other movies, and The Clone Wars is an amazing cartoon series. Even Rebels is good. There was just too many holes in this, too many things that just didn't feel right, and it's not even all the actors' faults, because I think even Natalie Portman did a fairly good job in this movie. She was a little monotone, but I think that was the role. I think, you know, being queen and having to have like 18 different people that can assume your role to hide your identity at any given point, you know, if you have a lot of inflection in life in your voice, it's hard for other people to mimic. I get it. I get what was going on. I do like the movie. I really do, because it is Star Wars. But, you know, I'm rating this on our Star Wars scale. If this was a normal movie, I might still give it a 7 to 7.5. On a Star Wars scale, this is a 6. Just because they could have done so many things better. And I know that hindsight is always 20/20. George Lucas himself may think that he could have done some things better. The fact remains that they didn't. And they had enough time with the years between Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace. If he wouldn't have gone and tinkered with the old movies and spent time building the new one instead of playing and making special editions, I think he could have come up with a little bit better stuff. That, and I think if he had done what he did originally and had other people direct instead of directing himself, it might have done him some service. But that being said, it is his property and whatever he wants to do with it. George Lucas gave this gift to the world. Still giving it a 6, but it is still a fun movie. It's a popcorn movie, more so than any of the other Star Wars movies. The other Star Wars movies have a little more gravitas in it, so that's my rating. That's where I'm at. So there you go, from the Cynic Radio Podcast, Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. We're going to call it 6.75. This was a lot of fun. We're going to be bringing more Star Wars content for you for the next few weeks. We got a break before The Walking Dead. When it comes back, be sure we'll be there. Next week also, we'll be coming back with more What's Up and Really. But until then, you have reached the end. This is it of episode 47 of the Cynic Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Igarhi, and with me has been my Padawan learner and co-host, Cynic. Also joining us has been Sith Lord Ryan George from the Jimwits Podcast. You can find him over at thejimwits.com. Please send us your comments, questions, concerns, and whatever the hell some midichlorians are to cynicradio@gmail.com. Find us on the internet at cynicradio.com. Look for us on Facebook at facebook.com/cynicradio. And find us on Twitter at cynicradio. Also, head over to tpublic.com and get your own Cynic Radio Podcast gear. We got t-shirts, shirts, cups, everything else, stickers. You want it, we got it. Go there and support your favorite podcast by wearing some of your own Cynic Radio Podcast swag. Thank you again for all the continued support and love. We love every single download we get. You guys are the absolute greatest. And until next time, don't get captured.
Follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and at cynicradio.com. Available for download on iTunes.
Oh, Jar Jar is the shit.